Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by our intern minister, Dame Clements, our director of religious education, Lily Rappaport, our music director, Hal Walker, several musicians, and two members of the congregation who are participating in our service today, Brad Bolton and Joe Fatchett McGee.
I'm going to invite Cameron Mack to come light the chalice. And our chalice lighting words today come from one of my favorite storytellers, Shel Silverstein from Where the Sidewalk Ends. I'm going to say a phrase, and then I'll ask you to repeat it. If you are a dreamer, come in.
If you are a dreamer,
a wisher, a liar,
a hoper, a prayer,
a magic bean buyer.
If you're a pretender,
come sit by my fire.
For we have some flax,
golden tails to spin. Come in.
Come in.
Make them hear.
are just days before the election. It's been a tough journey this year. So many painful and damaging words have been spoken. Sharp divisions have fractured relationships between neighbors, between friends, between family. It's been a tough journey this year, and we're glad it is almost done. In the hours that remain, we will do what we can to realize the outcome we believe is in the best interest of our nation. But let us not forget, in the hours that remain, to do what we can to realize our own capacity to breathe peace and to be love. Whoever is elected, each of us is needed now. No matter our politics, we are needed now to be agents of peace and advocates of love for ourselves, for each other, and for this earth we call home. Come, let us worship together. In this vibrant community, there's often more going on than we have time to tell you about in detail, and yet there's one group whose details are important for you to attend to because they're the group that's preparing for the annual service auction, and we have an announcement from them.
Good morning. Our auction is coming up soon on December 3rd, and we really need your donations. And this is a little reminder and some suggestions about what you might donate.
Starry, starry night. Starry, starry night. That wasn't even planned. Four more weeks till auction night. We need your help to fill the hall with donations, large, medium, and small. Don't know what to give? Is there something that you love to do? Events and services and food. Here's some ideas to inspire a form or two.
Donate some items for the silent auction. Jewelry, homemade food, baked goods, preserved food, beer and wine. Beautiful and useful things for the home, handcrafted items, toys, tickets. You could coordinate an outing or an event, including things like a campfire jam, a poetry reading, an art gallery tour, a hike, a bike ride, a winery tour, a house concert, a New Year's Day brunch, a camp out, a picnic, storytelling, theater, a garden tour, or a getaway weekend. You could donate a piece of art, either made by you or something nice that you have that somebody else might like. You could host a themed dinner party, including Indian, French, Italian, Greek, Hungarian, barbecue, Irish, Japanese, Spanish, fondue, Japanese, pizza, seder, locavore, vegetarian, vegan, or cardiologist nightmare. You could offer a workshop like beading, art card making, art history, mandala making, canning, magic, or ugly Christmas sweater making. You could throw a party for the Oscars, or cocktails, or humor, movie marathon, card night, tea tasting, Kentucky Derby, tapas, music theme party, or a talk like a pirate party. You could offer homemade food items made to order, such as pie, cake, cheesecake, lasagna, chili, bread, holiday cookies, or baklava. You could offer a service, like a personalized portrait, or a painting, or poem. A hand-sewn or hand-knit garment, computer repair, electrical work, leaf raking, voice coaching, French lessons, piano lessons, painting lessons, knitting lessons, babysitting, massage, Reiki, henna, a puppet show, music for an event, or maybe a Banakula birthday party. Or you could fill a basket with fun stuff like coffee and tea, crafting supplies, pet treats, toys, or a theme basket like Harry Potter or Doctor Who, housewares and linens, booze, popcorn, or chocolate. So if you're going to plan an event, please pick a date and make sure you put it in the calendar at the auction table downstairs so that you're not competing with somebody else. If you need an empty basket to fill, you find those down there too. And you'll also find donation forms, lots of them, and friendly people to help you fill them out. Please don't donate anything without a form. Thank you.
Starry, starry night. Pick a date and don't wait long. Put it on the calendar and don't forget to reserve Fessenden Hall if you need it. Take a basket now, fill it in the next few weeks. but tell us what you plan to bring. Forms are due in to us in only 2 short weeks.
This is a community that plays together, that serves together, and that prays together too every Sunday. So I'd like to invite you now to prepare yourself for a time of prayer and meditation. If you're holding things in your hands, I encourage you to put them down so that you can have them open as a reminder to open yourself. Tune into your breath. Tune into the quality of light in the room. Tune into the presence of these others we gather with. Tune into yourself. Breathe together. As we prepare for a time of silence with these words from Rabbi Chaim Stern, one of the leading liturgists of the Reform Jewish tradition in the United States. Over 3 decades, he compiled the entire 3-volume series of the Gates prayer book, and this is a selection. There is a mystery within me, and try as I may, I cannot come to the end of it. It teaches me reverence for the unfathomable wonder at my core. Hidden one, you alone know the secret within the secret within me. For are you not that secret? I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. This is a simple body prayer. And if you would like to participate, I invite you to rise in body or in spirit and begin with your hands either in a prayer posture in front of you or together over your heart. And then you can follow the motions to the prayer with me. O gracious spirit of life and of love, we gather here today to reconnect with ourselves. May we open our hearts to ourselves and honor the divinity within us. Just as we reach out our arms to honor the divinity in every other person, help us to be open to the connections, not only the ones we have made with people who we know, but also to the ones we have not yet made with all of the people with whom we might make contact this week. We open our hearts to the divinity within and the divinity in each person, and we lift our arms in thanks for the blessings of this life, the blessings of connection with people, and with animals and plants and with this earth, which is our home. We have been abundantly blessed, blessings enough to share. And so we gather up our blessings and reach down to touch the ground, to center ourselves, on our home, this earth, to thank the earth for all of the blessings she bestows upon us, and to remember that this is the ground of our being. O gracious spirit of life and of love, having opened ourselves and given thanks and centered again, we rise now and return to our hearts and pledge to live this day and aspire to live this week, remembering and honoring the peace within ourselves, because we know it is true that the peace within is what makes it possible for us to be agents of creating peace without. May it be so, and amen. Thank you. The universe is made of stories, not atoms. That line comes from one of Muriel Rikester's poems and is a source of inspiration for David Loy's book, The World is Made of Stories. He introduces his book by responding to Rikester's observation. These are his words. Not atoms? Of course the world is made of atoms. That's one of our important stories. What other stories make our world? Creation myths, folk and fairy tales, 17-syllable Japanese haiku, and 3-day Indonesian shadow puppet dramas, novels, romantic and fantastic and graphic, television soap operas, obituaries, birth announcements, how-to manuals, and how you're feeling this morning, and what you did on your vacation, what plan to make for the weekend. If the world is made of stories, stories are not just stories. They teach us what is real, what is valuable, and what is possible. Without stories, there's no way to engage the world because there is no world, and no one to engage with it because there is no self. This is not to deny or assert that there is a world apart from our stories, only that we can't understand anything without storying it. To understand, he says, is to story. This morning, I invited two members of the congregation to tell a story of spiritual discovery. I've wanted to do this ever since the summer, after Brad Bolton returned from a trip and was talking about his experience there. The story was moving to me, and I wanted him to have the opportunity to share it with you. And so that started me thinking about how we could create a service around our stories. And I invited Jo to add hers for a completely different way of telling a story about finding meaning. The stories are stories of spiritual discovery. Now, when I say the word spiritual, I'm talking about connectedness. Connectedness to self, to others, to earth and her creatures, to the stars and the sea, to the past and to the future, to the holy within, between, among, and beyond us, to mystery. When I talk of the spiritual life in those terms, it sounds like something beautiful and sublime, and sometimes it is. But other times, the process of realizing the breadth and depth of our connections takes us into territory ranging from the uncomfortable to the terrifying. But as the story that Dave shared with us during the Time for All Ages reveals, if we can follow the threads to greater connection, even when it's uncomfortable, we stand to find ourselves enriched in ways we might never have previously imagined. David Petit, who wrote that story, was so proud of the genealogical work his family had done, so proud of his ancestors and their stories. And when he discovered that one of his ancestors had enslaved people, it undermined the narrative he thought he knew about his family. And when he found out that not only did they enslave people, but they participated in the slave trade, it undermined that narrative of his family story even further. It was disorienting, and he was ashamed. He could have chosen to compartmentalize that knowledge he had found and to stick with the narrative of all of the wonderful things his ancestors had done. But instead, he decided to follow the thread, to follow that thread of an uncomfortable, disorienting story, and to see where it would take him. If he hadn't done that, he never would have found his way through to connection with the descendants of the people his ancestors had enslaved, and he never would have found the creation of solidarity with those people and the possibility of creating a new legacy. The life of the spirit isn't confined. It isn't confined to one story we think we already know. It isn't confined to prayer books or to liturgies or even to the realm of the religious. We're all connected. The two stories we're about to hear illuminate the reality of our connectedness in very particular ways. Through their particularity, I hope you will be inspired to tend your own connections and maybe even to tell your own stories, because stories are how we make sense of our experience. Stories are how we share our experience with others. Our stories begin before we were born, and they will carry on even after we die. Our stories are how we know who we are and how we remember what really matters.
Very often, the path to spiritual discovery begins with a tragedy, and this is how mine began. On February 4th, 2005, I was the victim of a hate crime and police brutality. What was supposed to be a simple shopping trip became one of the worst days of my life. After buying a few things at Walmart and heading out to my car, I got into an altercation with three adults in a black Dodge SUV. As I was walking across the crosswalk, they sped up towards me, yelled profanities and homophobic slurs out their window, and one of the men even went so far as to exit the vehicle in an attempt to fight me. Out of fear and frustration, I tossed the remaining ice cubes from my empty cup of pop into their vehicle in a useless attempt to get them to leave me alone. This action led to their calling the police on me. By the time the two police cars arrived, I was safely inside my vehicle in the handicapped parking space. I explained to the officer what had happened. I also told him that I had many medical issues, specifically making sure to tell him that I have a nerve stimulation implant in the back of my head. I explained that the reason I threw my ice cubes at the other car was because I had been afraid my implant would become broken if the individuals had become violent with me. I informed him that I would forget the whole thing if I could just go home. The officer seemed less than thrilled with me, to the point of being annoyed. I did not understand why. He left and spoke to the other individuals, as well as the other officer. After a brief time, both officers approached my vehicle and told me that they were citing me for disorderly conduct. I was shocked. I asked if the three individuals in the black SUV were also being cited, and one of the officers said, "Why? They didn't do anything." I lost my cool at this point. I said a few things about how police officers are supposed to protect and serve, and that I certainly did not feel they were handling the situation correctly at all. One thing led to another, and all of a sudden, both police officers were on top of me inside my car, roughly pulling me out. I was trying to protect myself as much as possible because I was being physically injured. I kept yelling for them to stop because I was afraid my implant would become broken. The next thing I knew, I was out of my vehicle, face down on the cold, slush, and snow-filled pavement. That was when I felt an elbow to the back of my head. I woke up in the back of a police cruiser having a seizure. My first seizure since getting an implant in 2012. From there, I went to the hospital in an ambulance, and then from the hospital to the Stowe Police Department. There I was fingerprinted, photographed, and charged not only with disorderly conduct, but also with resisting arrest and obstructing official business. I started having seizures on a regular basis. A few weeks after the incident, I found out my implant was completely broken and had to be replaced through a very costly and difficult surgery. I got a criminal defense attorney and fought the charges. After an 8-hour-long trial, the jury found me not guilty of resisting arrest and obstructing police business. Unfortunately, because the other individuals were never charged with a crime, and because I admitted I threw the ice into their car, the judge was forced to find me guilty of the disorderly conduct charge. He was so angry at the police for their mishandling of the situation, however, instead of the customary $1,000 fine, he assessed me a fine of $25. I am now in the process of suing the Stowe Police Department and the individual police officers in federal court for violating my 4th and 14th Amendment rights. During this entire fiasco, I had a tremendous amount of love and support from my wife and children, my friends, and my church community. My family of origin seemed only to be concerned with my suing the police department, but my friends and loved ones called to see how I was doing, sent cards and personal messages, and listened to me tell the story in an attempt to heal from it. Several members of this church community, including a very pregnant Melissa, even came out to my trial and sat for hours on end to show me their love and support. I have never felt as loved as I did during this time. My wife was my rock through it all. With her love and support, I was able to summon an inner strength I didn't know I had. She helped me to see that none of this was my fault and that I was never alone. And while I wish that this had never happened to me, it did help me see that I have people in my life that will be there for me no matter what. I will forever be grateful to this church community for standing beside me during the difficult time.
Cicadas are magical to me. Munching tree roots for 17 years, then raucously exploding above ground at the end of their life like a burst of fall color. In fact, the genus name for these bugs is Magicicada, precisely because of their magical life cycle. This year was their year to emerge, so I planned a trip to southern Ohio like I've done every 17 years just to hear them sing at their loudest. My journey became more involved, however, when I read that Wayne Kritzky, a top cicada scholar, collects data from non-scientists on the location, species, and density of these special bugs. So I bought a GPS, designed a method of collecting data while driving, and traveled 1,800 miles in June throughout the range of the Brood 5 cicadas. I started this journey with two goals, neither of which were spiritual: to collect as much data as I could and to be in the middle of the thickest and loudest swarm of bugs I could find. Sick, I know. I fell into a rhythm of driving a minute, stopping, listening, and logging data over and over, 8 hours a day, on the smallest of back roads. It was tedious, but interesting to discover where the bugs were and where they were not. Where they were loudest, I would stop a while to record them and rejoice in the racket. Right away, I could hear the constant high screaming of the Cassini species, and shortly thereafter, the quieter, haunting hoo of the Decim. Finally, the papery ch-ch-ch-ch-ch of the Decula. Once in a while, I would hear the hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo call from a male Decim approaching a female, or the faster hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo call just before mating. But something unexpected was growing inside me. While I was deciphering cicada calls, a fascination, an attraction, a spirituality. I felt like a traveler spending quality time in a foreign country, learning the language, the culture, and about the land in which they live. As the miles piled up, they became my extended family. I knew them, no matter where they were. People and places came and went, but the cicadas were the one constant presence. Even though it was a one-way relationship, of course, I felt closer to the bugs and their calls than I felt to the owner of the bed and breakfast at which I stayed. The racket became such soothing music that I would smile when I heard an especially loud group, and it became a chanting meditation in reverse. Instead of humming Om, I was quieting my mind by listening to the bugs. For hours, I would stop every third of a mile and actively listen. Active listening instantly stops my mind from chattering because I can't properly hear and talk to myself at the same time, a skill I probably developed years ago learning to transcribe music. I was spending hours a day in this light state of meditation, and like that moment when seeing a beautiful sunset, felt somewhat removed from the human world and at one with the cicada world. Cicadas are wonderful tools for reviewing the various stages of my life. Now, I've never paid a cicada $90 an hour for therapy, mind you, but every time they return, I remember their previous emergences and I reflect on who I was in those years. 17 years ago, 1999, Marta Dominguez, a former member of this church, and I traveled to the Cambridge area to hear them. I was rediscovering myself after a divorce and feeling free as a bird. During the previous emergence in 1982, I camped overnight at Blue Rock State Park in the thickest populations of cicadas I'd ever experienced. I lost part of my hearing for hours after I left the area, which is the sign of a really great cicada experience. That year, I was having fun dating a motorcycle mama and going to college a second time. So, who am I this year compared to who I was during the previous emergences? I realize that my 2016 self still has trouble immersing in the social human experience, just like my 1982 self did, but I'm slowly getting better at it. My 2016 self is not as giddy and impulsive as my 1999 self, and I'm better grounded now. Some of my old shortcomings I had in 82 and 1999 are still with me, yet I've grown quite a bit in other ways. Bug therapy is good therapy. You don't have to travel days to experience this kind of meditation. I hear katydids and tree crickets in my backyard that I never noticed until this summer after my ears were attuned to the cicadas. And you can do this too. Stop. Listen for high-pitched calls in your yard. Notice the quality of the sound. Once you hear them, you will always hear them. And then, let them quiet your mind. So, where were the loudest cicadas in all 1,800 miles of chasing them? In the front yard of the bed and breakfast I stayed at in Caldwell, Ohio, on a busy downtown street. I had to cover my ears just to get to the car. This song was written by a member of this church, Jim Scott, during the last emergence of cicadas in Ohio, 1999. It's an audience participation song. You only need to know two words, agonizing, terrorizing. And you sing them during the chorus with great fervor, fear, and trepidation. Now, this is how it goes. I'll just do an example for you. I was driving, Oh, cicada blues, agonizing. Cicada blues, terrorizing. Hey, you got it. Some of you remember this song very well, I can tell. I was driving my car on Highway 43 when my windshield got covered and I couldn't see. Listen to my story, I swear it's a piece of true. I pulled over with a crunching sound, and you wouldn't believe what I had found. I'd become another victim of a plague of cicada blues. Oh, cicada blues, agonizing. Cicada blues, terrorizing. Came for 17 years, cicada blues. I got out of the car, and to my surprise, there were thousands of creatures with beady red eyes. They look like something right out of Hitchcock's scripts. Then suddenly my hearing just went haywire with a deafening noise like a rocket on fire. I thought surely it was the apocalypse. Oh, cicada blues. Cicada blues. I got those 17 years, cicada blues. Oh, everywhere I stepped, they were under my feet. But my dog thought it was all you can eat. Those cicadas were thicker than a Cuyahoga fog. Well, Rover ate as many as he possibly could. And when he was done, then I understood how they got that old expression, sick as a dog. Oh, cicada blues. Cicada blues. I got those 17 years, cicada blues. Well, they say there's only one true way to defeat them, and believe it or not, that is to eat them. And I'll try not to exaggerate about their size. They're nearly as big as a Goodyear blimp. And some people taste and say it tastes like shrimp, but I believe I'll stick with a burger and fries. Oh, cicada blues. Cicada blues. I got those 17 years, cicada blue. Well, it's been hot, and I've been hoping that I could sleep with the windows open, but it sounds like a freight train running right under my bed. Oh, all night long, those monsters are singing, and in the morning, my ears are ringing. If I don't get some sleep soon, I'll be dead. Oh, cicada blues, cicada blues. I got those 17 years, cicada blues. Millions of cicadas are hurting my ears. They only come around every 17 years. But when 2016 comes around, it'll be too soon. Oh, cicada blues, cicada blues. I got those 17 years, cicada blues.
Go as you go with gratitude for the connections that help you know who you are and what really matters, and open to all the possibilities for connections that are just waiting to be made. Go in peace.